Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 226 for January 24th. Hey, lighten up! Watch Auto Line After Hours live at Autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website. Well, here we are, another episode of Autoline After Hours. I got a great group with me today. I'll start with Joe White from the Wall Street Journal. Great having you here, Joe.
Good to be here.
Tony Swan, car and driver, and a whole bunch of other stuff.
Yes, what do you need? Show me the money.
And Henry Payne from the Detroit News.
Hey, John, nice of you to have me. This is my rookie event.
Your debut. We got to tell everybody that Henry's background is really as an editorial cartoonist.
Yep.
Who has now become the auto critic.
That's right.
For the Detroit News. And when I was scratching my head about what makes this guy think he knows how to review cars, I learned that you race vintage Porsches.
I'm a lifetime motorhead. Grew up in go-karts, racing go-karts, and then I've been racing on the vintage circuit for 25 years in Porsches and Lolas and all kinds of neat stuff.
So you're good in our book. You're welcome on After Hours here, Henry.
Thank you very much.
Well, last week was the media days for the Detroit Auto Show. It's still going on with the public. But, boy, the big thing I got to believe is that aluminum-intensive Ford F-150.
Yeah, that was one of the big things for sure. It's a very big thing, too. It does not look like a light, flimsy truck. And, of course, that's by design. But it is 700 pounds lighter.
By 750. Design. We don't even know the full info yet. Well, here's the weird thing. Who was at the press conference?
Were
you there? Now, I'm told, because I missed the press conference, I was doing other interviews.
Great press conference.
They never said the word aluminum.
That's no.
True. What the hell is that about?
Well, because
here's aluminum truck. It's the game changer.
I'll take a first shot at that, but I mean, among the many things that they're going to try to communicate about this truck, they want you to know that it's lighter. They want you to know that it's more efficient. They haven't given the mileage numbers yet. They do not want you to associate this with aluminum as in tinfoil, okay? If anything, they want you to think of it as aluminum as in military vehicles that, you know, that fight wars for us and that can take a shell. Or a ship or maybe a warplane. That's the kind of aluminum that they want you to think about. And it's going to be interesting to see how they communicate what they've done.
But everybody there knew that the thing's made out of aluminum.
Sure. Why? Yeah, but the consumer, and what's driving this, a big thing that's driving this is government regulation, right? It's not that the consumer has said, I want an aluminum truck. I mean, to your average consumer, aluminum means tin cans. It's soda cans. That's what aluminum means to the customer.
I'm not sure that's entirely true, because we hear a lot of stuff about manufacturers coming in with cars with aluminum suspension members and things like that, and the manufacturers are bragging about that.
Yeah, in fact,
Tony, they don't market them that way. I mean, unless you're a true motorhead, and we got four motorheads here, unless you're buying an Audi R8 or something, and then the marketing team says to you, or a Corvette Z06, so it's got an aluminum chassis. That means something to a motorhead, but your average consumer, an F-150 is right in the middle of average consumer country. Aluminum is not necessarily a selling point. That truck sells because it's reliable and because it's strong.
Yeah, built for it tough. And so, I mean, they're going to have to make... Ford doesn't need me to carry their water, but I will remind everyone that Ford has done a pretty slick job communicating about another technology that they have that 4 or 5 years ago many of us would have thought was dead on arrival, and that is a V6 engine in a large pickup truck.
Turbo V6.
Turbo V6 engine. And, you know, they were nervous as cats, and I remember interviewing them. Some of you know you might have done the same. When they're all, we're going to convince people that this V6 EcoBoost is just as powerful and just as potent and strong, all this stuff. Well, look, they got 40% of their mix now is the V6 EcoBoost. Yeah. And they've done a pretty smart job of marketing that.
And charge $1,800 more for that.
Which is really the most important point here. It doesn't matter. All the other stuff doesn't matter. It's $1,800 of revenue in the pocket. So I'm sure that many of the same marketing whizzes who figured out, you know, how to get Dennis Leary to say, "Tark, it's what opens your beer." I'm sure they got Dennis practicing various lines that are related to the aluminum bodies.
we got to talk about Bob Letts this hour, too, so we can do his Bob Letts. Joe does great voices.
They're also putting that V6 in the new Navigator,
The refresh.
Yeah, right. It's a refresh, but it's pretty extensive.
And not aluminum. Not yet.
Not yet.
But it will get there, right. So what do you guys think? Here's Ford going aluminum truck. Meanwhile, General Motors is coming out with smaller trucks that might even get better fuel economy and are almost as capable. Who's got the better strategy here?
And let's not forget Chrysler, which has which is going sort of diesel and 8-speed transmission, sort of a high gear transmissions, if that's the way to put it. Yeah, there's three different strategies. It's really interesting.
Well, and Joe, we had a real interesting piece by Carl Henkel in the Detroit News a couple weeks ago that at some point, and given the federal mileage standards, all these companies are going to go more heavily into aluminum. And what's different about Ford, obviously, compared to these other companies, is they weren't in bankruptcy. So Ford was able to raise the capital necessary to go all in on aluminum. I mean, this is hugely expensive. And that's, I think that's the other equation here, John, is it's not just that developing an EcoBoost V6 is an expensive proposition. Aluminum is a lot more expensive than steel.
Two to three times more.
Yeah, this is their highest margin product, the F-150, and they can make this work on a mass basis, but at what cost to their margins? I mean, developing EcoBoost technology, developing aluminum skins for your truck, that's going to eat into your margins.
Yeah.
So what's the cost to the country company in the long term?
Does this open the door for Ram and Chevy to underprice Ford? Because that EcoBoost engine, that's about $1,000 more per engine than a pushrod.
Well, but so far, look, true, and so far Ford has been able to put the money in their pocket and still retain leadership by a wide margin in this segment. But I agree that, I mean, there's plenty at risk in a strategy. I mean, the EcoBoost is something where it was pretty easy for them to say, you're getting more towing capability, and I know people argue about the actual mileage of the truck in the real world, but they're able to advertise higher mileage and more towing capability. That's comparatively an easy sell. The aluminum's going to be a little trickier.
I mean, also you talk about margins, and I think that's a good point. How much of that is going to get passed along to the consumer? What kind of premium can they charge for these new trucks? They're going to be more expensive.
Well, the mileage, honestly, it's kind of an obvious statement, but the mileage is going to have to be eye-popping.
Yeah, right.
30 miles per gallon highway?
I don't know. I know
that's what they're shooting for. Yeah. The
highway MPG on this thing better be eye-popping, or people are going to sit there. It's amazing how sophisticated consumers are. And you can look up and down, and you can see that the vehicles with technology where it doesn't pencil, people can look at it and say, I'm never going to get that back. Or I'm going to get that back in 9 years. Stuff doesn't sell. So they're really going to have to have some good numbers to make that work.
Well, I don't think the individual consumer is going to do that math. But the people who are going to do that math are the fleets.
I mean, the contractors with
fleets of these trucks, they're going to do the math on we've heard 3 to 4 miles per gallon increase as a result of just the aluminum weight savings. So you factor that over a fleet of cars. That's a lot of savings to fleets. And I think that's how Ford is approaching this. I mean, you can't go to the public and talk government regulation. That goes right over their head. But you can talk about we're the high-tech company. These F-150s, they have the high-tech EcoBoosts in them. They're the first truck with all LED lights, and they'll save you three. So you can talk tech. We're the tech company.
Yeah, and that's
you want to buy high-tech. And so that way they just increase market share. And that's how they get their cars.
Now you talked about you mentioned the GM strategy, which is also interesting. I mean, GM, and I think you're right. I think an aluminum sort of Hail Mary in a 2009 GM was a tough pass, and they didn't take it. But I do think it's interesting what they're trying to do. They're basically trying to resegment the truck market and bring back the idea of the midsize truck, which is pretty much gone out of the market except for the Toyota Tacoma and the Nissan Frontier.
Toyota in particular.
And Mark Royce and others at GM have been pretty upfront about saying that they envy and are jealous of Toyota's position in that sort of what they call a lifestyle truck. But I guess my question is how, you know, that market went away for a reason, or largely went away for a reason. And it's going to be interesting to see, especially if there's a, you know, Ford hits the bogey on the mileage, whether there's going to be a big market for a somewhat less capable truck that gets somewhat better mileage. I mean, I don't know, but I think it's not without risk in its own way.
Well, I don't think the GM regards these new trucks, the midsize trucks, as trucks that are going to go to people who are using them for work. They see them as lifestyle. And the other thing that makes it possible is the transaction price on big trucks is now well up into the 40s.
Oh, yeah, it's a luxury
product.
So
that's where they see their opportunity. That market could come back. And I think that they're probably right.
Right. Well, and I think there's another piece in this. I was talking to Mark Royce during the auto show, and I said, explain to me how introducing another truck helps you with federal mile per gallon standards. Because the new CAFE rules are not an average over the fleet. They're specific to each footprint. Mm-hmm. So how does introducing a new footprint help you with CAFE? And he was a little opaque, or non-opaque. opaque, I think, is the word. He's a little opaque.
You didn't get the answer you were looking for, is what you're saying.
But I think the other calculation there is that segment, that midsize segment, is tired. And I think they see they can come in there, grab a lot of market share, make a lot of money.
Well, they have to grow the segment. They can't just grab market share because the segment's just not that big.
No. Right.
That's what they anticipate doing, and they've got a couple of really good-looking trucks. Yeah, and, of course, these are not tiny little trucks anymore.
No,
these are pretty good-sized trucks.
No, we're not talking about the S10 by any
right.
or something like that.
But see, I think all these companies have to make money. That's the thing. I mean, these regulations are expensive over time. They got to make money. And I think GM's calculated they can take a lot of market share away from Nissan and Toyota, grow the segment a little bit.
The challenge would be not taking market share from their own more expensive Silverado.
That's right. And that's why everybody abandoned those trucks.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, I'm pretty confident that's why Ford isn't bringing a Ranger, you know, back, because they figure, look, you know what, we sell 700,000+ F-Series, probably less than that of the F-150, but a healthy number of F-150s. And they don't want to have a competitor to that very lucrative franchise sitting on their own lot, right? So they don't.
They don't. What I find fascinating is, let's say the F-150, the aluminum one, works like gangbusters. GM can't respond for another 8 years. I mean, the Silverado just came out. You leave a platform in place for 8 years.
You're right, I'm sure, up to a point, but I would also note that General Motors has, and Mark Royce, again, in his previous job, and I assume in his job as head of product development, hasn't changed his views on this. You know, Mark Royce was very much an advocate or a proponent of, if you miss a target with a vehicle, go in and do what you can to fix it ASAP. I mean, the Malibu is an example of that. I think there's maybe a couple others.
But those were very minor changes.
But they might be able to hang some more aluminum on a Silverado.
Right.
Well, and that's a good point. I mean, the Silverado also already has an aluminum hood on it.
Mm-hmm.
It's already 200 pounds lighter than the F-150. I mean, the F-150 wasn't coming in here on parity with the Silverado. It's the heavier truck. So Silverado and the Ram were both lighter than the F-150. So they started a different point. And again, this consumer question, consumers are going to be comparing aluminum and steel trucks. How much are Dodge and GM going to take advantage of that? Because with aluminum to the consumer, there's an insurance issue. Aluminum takes longer to repair. It's more expensive to repair. I think Ford's right. I think these alloys they put together are going to be, they're proven, they're tested. These are going to be tough trucks. But aluminum by its nature is going to potentially raise the insurance costs for customers. And, you know, how are the competitors going to play that game in the consumer arena? I mean, it's hardball. That's a very competitive
segment. They'll use every competitive advantage.
If the amount of flack and that's being thrown up into the air by the rivals to Ford at this early stage, you know, almost a year before the truck is even introduced, is any indication, I think this is going to be the Battle of Britain. It's just going to be flack and shells all over the place for
the best line was Joe Hinrichs, who said, "John, this changes everything." And I said, "Yeah, it does." He says, "No, you you didn't hear me. He said, this changes everything.
Yeah. Well, right.
Because they got to change their body shops, their stamping presses. Yeah. They got to change every way that this car gets or truck gets manufactured.
Well, and again, I mean, and I think this, they think Ford folks have been pretty clear about, without being specific, but pretty clear about this. I mean, this investment in aluminum, I think, is not just about the F-150. I'm sure they're going to need to get the F-150 launched before they get too frisky, but I would not be surprised to see quite a number of their vehicles, you know, going into intensive aluminum, the large SUVs being a case in point, because I think it seems to me that Ford is very committed to aluminum as the answer to the, you know, how do we get class-leading fuel economy across the board. Their guys seem to think they've got a handle on how to manage this. So
right, and Joe, again, and to go back to the consumer marketing wars, I think Ford's in a very good position. You look at the market share or the sales that the Ford Fusion has gained in California over the last year, and a lot of that is marketing. We are tech, we are fuel efficient, we are hybrids with this Fusion, and you got the Fusion in California competing against Toyota, which used to have that halo. We were the tech company, we were the first in hybrids. Fusion, I mean, that marketing strategy is working in California, sales up 100% for the Fusion over the last year, so maybe that'll translate to trucks. I mean, as you say, the truck customer is pretty sophisticated because it's a small businessman. They look at costs. They're aware of tech. I mean, that could be a real winning marketing strategy.
I think it's really, you know, we can speculate on this all we want, but we've got to see what's going to be on those window stickers when they finally roll into showrooms.
Yeah. Well, I think Ford's got, they've got to swallow that initially. I mean, they're making 10 grand a truck, I think. But so they have some room
to
swallow.
Yeah.
Well, my suspicion or my guess is that they're not going to really be able to move the sort of the window sticker price band that much. But I'm sure they're.
I don't think so either.
But I'm sure they're going to try.
Who's going to eat the cost?
Well, I'm sure. I'm sure they're going to try to elevate the mix. You know, sell more trucks at 40 than they do today, and they sell plenty at that level today. You're right.
Chevy,
that's certainly the challenge.
Yeah. Chevy says their average transaction price now is something like 45 on a Silverado. So, yeah, the whole market, and that's what's opening the door for the Canyon and the Colorado,
right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's interesting because how fast could Ram or Ford react if all of a sudden they realize, boy, those little trucks are red hot. Everyone's buying them. I mean, they've got to be years away.
Well, Ford can run into and become an avid supporter of the Trans-Pacific Free Trade Agreement and start bringing Rangers in from Thailand. So I guess there's that, and you know what Chrysler Fiat or Fiat Chrysler would do. I guess they have to go break open the warehouse where they've got the molds for the Dakota.
Yeah. But there's such skepticism of the GM strategy because that segment has shrunk because the full size pickups are such a bargain relative to the midsize segment.
There's not enough space between them.
Right. And
yeah.
That's right. So here comes Ford with the F-150 with better gas mileage, just like a smaller truck. I mean, it really is fascinating. I mean, it's the story of the show. I mean, whoever thought that we'd right. we'd be obsessed with technology and trucks at a Detroit Auto Show? Yeah.
Well, who thought that materials would be sort of like the big sexy topic at an auto show?
Right.
You know, but it is. So.
Yeah. But speaking of the auto show, have you guys noticed? I mean, there's no more big green buzz at auto shows. Every
Not
auto
at this
show.
One.
Well, it's more than this
LA
one, Joe.
Too,
LA and last year at Frankfurt, there was nobody out saying we're the greenest auto show in the world like I've been hearing for the last decade. Yeah. To me, the green buzz thing is gone.
I will say, however, that two of the finalists for the European Car of the Year Award, which will be announced in Geneva, are electric cars.
The what, i3?
I can't remember offhand.
i3 is one.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think in Europe there's still. I mean, I was at the Frankfurt Auto Show, and there was still a pretty heavy green sort of haze, if you will.
Right. Well, the green church is just stronger in Europe.
Yeah. I mean, they've got
$8
a gallon gas. So it's economically sensible. It's culturally in tune with where Europeans are at on the subject of climate change. In the United States, you know, if those of you who haven't heard, we've got an oil revolution, a shale gas and shale oil revolution. Our fears about running out of oil, the whole peak oil thing has kind of gone off the map.
It's gone. It's dead.
Gas is stable at $3-something a gallon. And, you know, the trucks outsold cars in 2013, reversing the trend from the prior year. And you're right. I mean, this is my favorite sort of vision of, that really crystallized this for me when I went to the auto show. I walked up to the GM stand, and in the front are the redone SUV, large SUVs. Over there is the Colorado or the Canyon. I can't remember which one, but one of those, the truck. Over there to the left is the Z06 Corvette, which is dynamite, total knockout. And you go walk back a little bit, and there's a line of half a dozen or so Camaros looking all snarly and mean. And behind the Camaros, tucked underneath sort of an overpass of some sort, is a little old Chevy Volt. With a thing in it, and they've kind of basically relegated it to the back of the stand. And when Joe Biden was here, Joe Biden drooled all over the Corvette Z06 and went on and on about how he likes to burn rubber in his 67 Vette, and didn't say word one about the Volt, which was not so long ago, you know, the car that President Obama was
darling,
buy and own, and you know, when he got out of the White House. So I mean, the whole thing is, even from the point of view of the administration, which was behind all this stuff, they're just like, no.
But I think that's the key point, Joe. You just hit on it. Is the politicians are out of these companies. I mean, they've divested from GM. Fiat now has full ownership of Chrysler. You didn't have a stream of politicians on the floor this year other than Joe Biden, because the government's out. And so I think to some degree the industry is now returning to its roots. And what it's doing, it's green. I mean, green is pervasive in this show, but it's green in the sense that it's on this industry's terms. They're green in the F-150. They're green in the Mustang, bringing a four banger into the Mustang. They're dealing with the rules, but in terms of the customer, in terms of the taxpayer, they don't have to speak to the taxpayer as owners anymore. And
right.
Now they're back to speaking to us as sellers of a product.
That's
and,
right.
And electrics have proven now, and hybrids, they're a niche market. They're muscle cars. They're 3% of the market. So you appeal to that niche of the market, and otherwise you sell people what they want.
Another aspect, I think, to your point of this greening, this kind of subtle greening, is increasing efficiency in internal combustion engines, and that goes on and on. And they keep getting better and better, and we keep seeing, you know, 8 and 9-speed transmissions and that sort of thing. So that's not going to go away anytime soon.
And that seems to be what, I mean, again, if you look at the, I mean, you look at the U.S. market, frankly, if you look at any market, that's what people are buying. They're buying, you know, they're buying capable vehicles that have a higher horsepower to weight ratio, partly because the weight is coming down. You know, that's what that's part of the F-150 story.
Yeah.
And it's certainly part of some of these other vehicles as well. The Z06, what is it, 625 horsepower?
Yeah.
You know, in a what I believe is a lighter, in a lighter vehicle, because I think that the base Corvette is a lighter vehicle. That's how this is being. I mean, you can, and I'm not an engineer, so bear with me. I mean, you can engineer a car for max fuel economy or sort of max performance. And what I think the car guys and car women are doing here is they're saying, you know what, we think that the customer wants. We want a higher horsepower to weight ratio, better fuel efficiency, but not so much of a skew toward fuel efficiency that they're not feeling good about driving the car.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for a lot of vehicles, they're kind of hitting it.
They are so far. But remember, you know, CAFE starts to ramp up now. In the next mm-hmm. couple of years, really ramps up. And the whole justification for coming out with all these expensive materials, powertrains, aerodynamic devices, and was that you were going to recoup that in your fuel efficiency savings. But to your point, Joe, if gas sticks in the $3 and change area, you don't get a payback for all that.
Yeah, look, I know Henry's written about this, so I'll let him say this, but I mean, look, you know, ideology is one thing, economics 101 is another. And you can have so much of a regulatory push on something, but if the market isn't pushing in the same direction, it gets tough.
Yeah.
But remember, these regulations came in when everybody believed peak oil's right around the corner. We're going to $150 a barrel, and that's just not going to happen.
Well, I mean, this is 55 miles per gallon by 2025 is the dumbest idea since 55, speed limit 55 miles per hour.
It has
no relation to how people drive. And that ultimately killed 55 the speed limit. And the problem with 55, the mile per gallon goal, is it has no correlation to what gas prices are. I mean, you know, so I did a review a couple weeks ago comparing the Volt, the Chevy Cruze diesel, and the regular base Cruze. And if you buy a Volt, it'll take you about 13 years to get mm-hmm. your cost back in gas. If you buy a diesel, which is where diesel prices right now are $3.80 compared to $3.20 for gas, it takes you about 60 years to get your mm-hmm. investment back versus the base Cruze. I mean, a base Cruze is $20,000. And unless you're in Europe and you're paying $8 a gallon and your diesel is discounted, you're not going to buy diesel, and there are very few people who are going to buy electric.
Except for Volkswagen. They've done pretty well with their diesels.
Well, they've got an audience of people. I think their brand attracts people who know the European technology.
Well,
and like
they've
it.
Got the diesels in multiple models. They've really been marketing it. And that's the point I've been making, is that last year, Volkswagen sold more diesels than any other car company sold hybrids, with the one exception of Toyota. I'm talking about the American market.
Right.
Volkswagen Group did 100,000 plus, with a quarter of the sales, or maybe even less, a fifth of the sales of the Ford Motor Company, which has got this mega all-out push on plug-ins and hybrids.
Well,
Volkswagen in the American market outsold them with diesel.
Well, that's another instance where you see, you know, the different companies taking different bets on technology. I want to pick up on something that what Henry was talking about. One of the talk of the show that was very clear to me in this discussion about CAFE is I think come 2017, when the CAFE rules specifically allow for or call for a review of what happens from 2018 to 2025, the hockey stick up to 54.5. Again, I think partly because the government is no longer a direct actor in the industry. I get the distinct impression that the auto industry is gearing up big time for that discussion, and are ready, willing, and able to say, if the market is the way it is today, with the same conditions relative fuel prices and all this stuff, I think they're prepared to say, 54.5 is not realistic. And by the way, the California EV mandates, fixed percentages of cars, the electric cars that have to be sold, that has to be dealt with because it's not realistic.
Right.
And I think that the industry is going to, they've been kind of playing possum on this during the period when the government was bailing them out and all that. But if things keep going financially as well as they're going, I think they will become more and more outspoken on that.
But probably the government will never back off. Politically, it probably
won't. Don't forget, there's
an
election happening in 2016,
John. That's true.
But California, I mean, that's a whole different situation, and they tend to be intransigent. I mean, it's very difficult to move them.
Well, but if you look at the history of California, even California...
The first time around, but I don't think it'll be as easy this time.
Yeah, I mean, they've had these mandates in place since 2000.
Well, this is the third go, right? Yeah, the first two goes fail.
Some things don't happen before they have to happen, and, people don't sell wine before it's time, and it's just not time yet for there to be a showdown over the EV mandate in California. But the Auto Alliance... has been pursuing it's legal action, but I know that they've been pursuing through the various processes open to them to try to get EPA to block this California mandate. They're pushing on that, and it's very irritating the California regulators. But I do think if you get to a position where, let's say, Mercedes or Ford or GM is unable, is barred from selling cars in California because they haven't met their quota, that changes everything, because I guarantee you there's plenty of Ford dealers, there's plenty of Toyota dealers. Toyota's going to have the same problem. All these dealers, all the people who are dependent on the auto industry in California will go into Sacramento and make their voices heard. So if it really comes to that, I'm not so sure that they won't modify it.
But because that brings the customer in. I mean, at what point do the companies or are the companies willing to take that step and say, okay, these regulations are so extreme, we can't sell you the cars you want. I mean, at some point you got to bring the customer into this equation.
Yeah.
And to date, these companies have been willing to spend a lot of money on technology, but they've also been spending a lot of money on lobbyists in order to get credits and loopholes to these rules. And they've been able to bump along nicely so far. So the question is whether this ever gets to a point where the consumer feels it. Because really, I mean, economics 101 tells you that if the government's serious about this, if the government's really serious about cutting CO2 and reducing fuel consumption, you do what Europe's done. You tax gasoline. That's how you bring a price point
right.
to the
never
market. Otherwise,
happens.
It's all lobbying. Yeah.
Never
right.
happened. No, it's never happened, and it won't happen. And it's absolutely, it's the answer.
Mm-hmm. No, there's no question. That's right. I mean, when I worked in
no
Washington briefly,
I got to ask
a really reasonably senior member of Congress about this at some function that I was at, and his basic response was, "Look, of course I understand that if you really want to do this right, you tax gas. It's political suicide. Next."
Yeah,
you know, it's like we're not going to do it. So right. forget about it. And
right.
that's basically the.
But you know, here's the thing that I find so interesting is that at $8 a gallon in Europe, we buy more electric cars than they do.
Well, that's because diesel is the answer in Europe because they've incentivized that, and that's a technology that people like.
The incentives are largely not as what they were, say, 30 years ago for diesel. I mean,
yeah, but diesel fuel is still, relatively cheap in Europe, and here, of course, it's 50, 60 cents.
Yeah,
but what I'm saying is
technology that people like and
your
trust.
Payback in Europe comes far, far faster if you buy an electric car. Even if you step out of a little diesel, your payback getting an electric comes far, far faster. And we buy more electrics than they do.
Well, I think the problem with electric, I'm not against electric cars. I think they're great. The problem with electric cars is that they are built, except for the Tesla, and the Tesla stands alone. It's also really a $90,000 car. There's only so many people on the whole planet who
more
can
like
afford
$110,000.
Well, okay, fine. But it's a very expensive car. The problem with mass market electrics is they all have stated ranges of somewhere 80 to 100 miles at best. In real life, less, especially if you're in cold climate. And they are really sort of useful for sort of commuting back and forth within a radius of about 40 miles. And so you need other cars. But most people aren't affluent enough to afford three or four purpose-built vehicles sitting in the driveway that they can't afford to own. I mean, most people in America don't make that kind of money.
Right.
So I think until somebody comes up with a breakthrough in battery technology that really drops the cost to a point where an ordinary human being making a decent wage can afford, and it's going to be a niche, as Henry said.
Well, and the convenience factor is huge. I mean, even in Europe, where the distances traveled are much less. I mean, there's much more of an inner city commute culture there than there is in this country. But it's driving the Chevy Volt, which should be the perfect answer, right? It's a plug-in. You go as far as you want on the battery, and then gasoline kicks in. But still, that's a demand on the consumer. The consumer both has to plug in every night. In my case, on one 110-volt wall plug,
which is
plugging in for 9 hours every night. I mean, 9 hours to recharge a battery. Okay. And then you got to keep high test premium in your gas tank for when the battery wears out. So I'm driving down the lodge every day, 25 miles one way to work. That's all I get out of the battery. I get 25 miles. It's half in this climate during the winter. That 50 miles per gallon range for a battery goes in half to 25,
right.
And that's just driving one way. So now, what if I have to veer off and do? What if I'm a salesman? I got to go do a sales trip in Toledo or in Chicago.
You're not buying that.
I'm on the gas engine all the time.
Yeah.
Why am I buying the premium for the battery?
And the other irony of all this, is that in many, not all, in many of the cities, certainly in Europe this is true, I think, and in the United States to a degree, in many of the cities where an electric car would make the most sense, the electric vehicle of choice is called a train.
Yeah.
But here's the other problem with cities, and this is why I think that they don't buy as many electrics in Europe as they do here, is so many more people in Europe live in apartments. So where are you going to plug in?
I lived in Washington, and I test drove. I did a column about test driving a couple electric, the new electric cars. And I lived in a second floor up apartment. And you're right, I had to run a cable out into the street. It was ludicrous. And It's just there's a lot of infrastructure, a lot of sort of it doesn't quite fit yet.
Right.
Well, they just aren't the magic that the Obama administration thought they were going to be. It's just as simple as that.
But that's why I still say that the most fascinating car on that show floor is the Tesla Model S. I mean, this thing gets 200-mile range. That seems to be established with a huge lithium-ion battery pack. By the way, if you talk to engineers and ask them about the life cycle, the carbon life cycle of a car. I mean, lithium ion is really energy expensive to manufacture. So over the life cycle of a car that's a battery car, how much CO2 are you really saving? But that technical point aside, Elon Musk is convinced with the forthcoming Model E, which he wants to be priced at $40,000, he's convinced that you can get electric cars at 200-mile range. If that's true, that's a game changer. As long as we're talking about EVs that get 50, 80 miles on the charge.
How is it a game changer, really? 200 miles, okay, even given that, it's still, what's the incentive for buying it?
If you can stay within a 200-mile range, that's pretty significant for doing family trip sales trips.
Well, right,
let me just say that. I think what's significant about that is if indeed you can mass produce affordable 200-mile range EVs, then I think this, the infrastructure starts to follow you.
Yeah.
Now, you can start to build an infrastructure out to 200 miles. I mean, as long as you're talking about 50-mile range, you're just talking about inner-city commutes. Well,
and that's Elon Musk's bet. I mean, he's building this supercharger network, and he insists consistently that he's confident that they can deliver this 200-mile range car at something like $40,000. It'd probably be more like $50,000. But to get to the numbers that they've sort of indicated in their various filings, that they want to get to something like 300,000, 400,000, 500,000 vehicles a year. I mean, I don't have the exact numbers on the top of my head, but that would, be multiples of what the electric car market is right now. Many multiples, not a small multiple.
Right.
And Joe,
if you go to those numbers, 300,000, you got to start building more coal plants.
let's just say the electricity will have to come from somewhere, and so it becomes a very different business. Elon Musk is demonstrably smarter than I am. We'll just stipulate to that. So I'm sure he's thought about all this, but I think it's still going to be a difficult throw, even for him and for the organization he's built. So it's going to be, we'll find out in 3 or 4 or 5 years.
We
will.
I don't know about his intelligence, but the confidence that you mentioned, that's astronomical. The guy is, he's an amazing person.
Yes. Hey, we got to take a quick break right here for our sponsor of the program. Ben, let's give a shout out to our good sponsor, Bridgestone and Firestone.
Introducing a car company that's never made a single car. We took the power of a 9-year-old V8 and gave it the impressive handling of Firestone's destination tire. Now, moms agree, every milk run feels like a victory lap. So whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
Whether it's on television, online, or through social media, AutoLine knows how to effectively get your marketing message to the people you want to reach. Contact Stacy Eamon today.
Six is a '66 Porsche. Yeah.
Hey, I wanted to ask you guys, the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety came out this week with its crash ratings for mini cars, small cars, and excoriated them. I personally believe this is a smear campaign on the part of the Institute to embarrass the auto industry. What do you guys make of it?
You want me to go first?
Sure.
All right. So it's not my job to speak for the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. However, I have spoken to them about this test, and so I feel like I can try to represent what they're up to. I mean, first of all, they've never liked tiny, tiny cars. Never, ever. So that's certainly...
Because they don't think they're as safe.
They don't think they're as safe, and they have now got this new, they call it a small offset crash test, which is basically designed to replicate what happens if you hit somebody with your headlight, basically, your driver's side headlight.
On the corners of the car.
Yeah. And it's a very violent test, and many cars, not all, many cars are not really designed to do well in that test because the federal government doesn't crash test cars that way. And up until a couple, 3 years ago, the Insurance Institute didn't crash test cars that way. But the Insurance Institute's view is that their mission in life is to reduce injuries and reduce damage, which their ultimate parents pay for. But I think they also view that it's their job to push the envelope, and it's not their view their job to copy or just emulate what NHTSA does, but to basically sometimes show NHTSA up and say, guys, we should have a more rigorous test. And that's what they're doing. And you're right. I mean, the mini cars, I think it was the Chevy Spark was the only one that passed the test. Everything else was terrible. And that is not what the mini car folks need right now when they're having enough trouble selling these cars, given that gasoline prices have stabilized and people are saying, I'll buy something bigger.
Look, I think it's a totally legitimate test. I think it's good what they're doing in this regard, because what they found is a very common occurrence in the field. You know, you don't go into a barrier, you know, nice frontal. You don't even do it partial offset. A lot of these small offset accidents happen in the real world. My problem with the Institute is it sort of kind of let people know it was thinking about this. And some companies picked up on the fact that, hey, maybe the Institute's going to start testing. Maybe we should start designing for this. I can only name three companies that I think caught this: Honda, Subaru, and Volvo. They're the only ones whose cars pretty much can meet this test. Nobody else saw this coming.
Well,
no one.
In the larger segments, some of the companies have kind of, I think Toyota went back and they had a lousy test with a Camry. I think I'm right about this.
Right.
And then they redid it. They probably put more metal where it needed
to
be.
They added more structure. But if you had known this was coming, it's easy, a whole lot easier, to bake this stuff into a clean sheet design than having a done design, and now you got to rip up everything. You add a lot more cost, a lot more weight. You affect the handling, the driving, the fuel efficiency of the car. My problem with the Institute is, why didn't it very clearly, crystal clearly, communicate to the industry, we think this is a problem, we're going to start testing for this. We're going to start testing in 2012, by the way, so that everyone had a heads up that this is coming. For them to go out and run these tests right now and say, oh my God, these things don't pass, they were never designed to pass the test.
I think every one of these news stories should come with an asterisk for that reason, because the people who are picking up the paper don't know how much this test has changed. I mean, from the last test, where 140 cars passed, now only 30 passed. I mean, that's a huge change.
Yeah.
Only one compact. Your average consumer, who doesn't follow the industry every day the way we do, all of a sudden thinks that cars have become less safe. That's not true. The test changed. The cars didn't change.
No,
cars are safer than ever today.
No, they are, and that's an important point. I talked to a year or so ago, or more than a year ago, when this first came out, and I think the Institute would argue that they did telegraph this. But I do think that they telegraphed it, even in the time frame that they telegraphed it. I think it would have been hard for companies, you know, it was not like a 5-year warning. It was like a couple year warning.
Mm-hmm.
And as you pointed out, I mean, to change the architecture of a car that's in market, sometimes you're 2 years away from that change. But you've probably already designed that next car. So I think it's tough for the companies, because they kind of got caught in, you know, with product cycles that were, you know, they just can't go quickly and fix this. And so you're right. They have to go and rip up the Volkswagen. I talked to them. One of the first rounds of these tests was the midsize cars, and the Volkswagen CC did horribly. I mean, the door flew off and all this other stuff. And, you know, I talked to the guys at Volkswagen, and I'm like, you know, look, this is not a test that we've ever seen in Germany. It's not something that popped up in our radar in their experience of monitoring or observing what happens with their cars that came up as a big problem. So, yeah, we're going to have to figure out what do we do. You know,
well, and speaking of product cycles, Joe, I mean, here we spent the first segment talking about how these guys are trying to get more aluminum and get weight out of cars in order to satisfy the federal government's mileage requirements. And now along here comes the Institute for the Insurance Institute and NHTSA, sure to follow, saying, no, you got to make your cars beefier. In order to satisfy our safety standards, so you got these people at odds.
This has been going on for some time with NHTSA and EPA. You've got divergent goals, but along comes the Institute, and these guys don't even have any official status, and yet you've got all these manufacturers kowtowing to them, and they're setting the standards, and I think it's ridiculous.
Well, there's a lot. Certainly, there are a lot of standards, and I do think the manufacturers are struggling with the conundrum that you outlined, which is, you know, and basically, and I think ultimately points toward more expensive materials. I mean, I think if you're in the business of selling or making high strength steel, or selling or making aluminum, or selling or making other, you know, high strength lightweight alloys, The CAFE rules and the safety rules are manna from heaven, because the car companies basically don't have a choice but to start, you know, buying these materials that I would say, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, they would have said, that's too expensive. No, it's pretty obvious they said that. That's too expensive. And now it's like, okay, come on, you know, come on back with your presentation
about that
material.
The only way to meet the regs.
Okay,
and then what's the next horizon? So we've got this this particular standard, okay, and everybody's going to play that game because they have to. So then there will be another one.
Well, I'll tell you what the next
horizon is. What are the limits?
Crash avoidance technology. I mean, I would not be at all surprised. In fact, they may have already done it. I think the Institute is, and to some extent NHTSA, have signaled both that they want to make crash avoidance technology.
They've already done it in Europe. You cannot get a five-star Euro NCAP unless you've got several of these technologies on your car.
Right, adaptive cruise and preempt, or I'm not using the right term,
forward
but braking. Forward collision warning.
FCW,
So that would be, would be surprised if that didn't become a part of the discussion.
Well, and you can see that coming into cars now. And again, that's the industry that's leading on that. I mean, and that'll help to make those regulations softer, just like anti-lock brakes. Anti-lock brakes are in everything now. A huge safety benefit. And with the electronics coming, you'll get these accident avoidance systems in there, which will help.
And I do think it's time to give the people who run the big car companies a little bit of credit, because I mean, I think most all of us have been watching this industry long enough to remember when the industry's approach to safety technology was, you know, no one stability control, no one. And now that has evolved to where, by and large, the industry is competing to see who can be first to put this kind of technology in.
Well, I think that's overall a good thing.
And the car buying public
chain. From not caring at all about this to being very concerned about safety. And so they'll check out, does this have five stars? Is it got a best
pick? Does it have side impact airbags? Does it have all these things?
Exactly.
Tony's stated point is that you can go too far with this stuff, or you can go too far too fast, undoubtedly. But I do think that overall, the industry's change in approach to this is a positive. I mean, traffic deaths are going down.
Don't you only have to meet one star? Isn't that? I think if you hit
legally,
I think you're good to go. You can sell cars legally with only a one-star rating.
But in reality, I don't think even a four-star car is a tough sell, I think, in most segments.
I wonder. I'd love to look that up and track star ratings to the sales of cars. I think you're right. You know, I think the public wants to know they're buying the safest thing.
I don't want to spend that much time online with a calculator.
But what's interesting is the larger numbers here, and you look at Europe, which has really gone hog wild with the hood designs and the pedestrian design, and that's all coming here. I mean, one of the interesting things
already,
if you walk around that beautiful Corvette Z06, and it has these funny little flares down around the right below the grill. And you ask an engineer, oh, that's an interesting aerodynamic trick. And the engineer says, no, that's because we're meeting the European pedestrian standard that kicks the ankles out from a pedestrian if they get hit head on in order to get the pedestrian off the hood. I mean, those safety standards are coming. But you look at Europe, you look at the United States, you look at fatality rates. I mean, they've been flat. And low and flat for a long time.
They've dropped significantly.
They dropped from 10 years ago or 15 years ago. They dropped significantly. They've kind of plateaued in the last couple of years. But it plateaued at a very low level.
Right. Just because you're getting down to a number now where.
But remember,
the cost benefit. I'm just saying the cost benefit. I mean, you're only killing one person per 100,000 miles. I mean, you're just getting down to such small numbers.
Yeah. Well, that's
so when does this investment in all this technology and materials. Does it pay back?
Well, that's why you're going to see the push for crash avoidance, because basically, I won't claim to know what people in Europe think, but in the United States, the federal traffic safety regulators have basically concluded that there's certainly more things you could do structurally to a car, But to get another significant leg down in the fatality race, you're going to have to deal with the fact that most people are lousy drivers. Mm-hmm. And that the research shows that before a collision, there's some huge and really shockingly embarrassing percentage of people don't even hit the brakes, or they don't hit them hard
or
enough.
Right.
And so that's the kind of thing that they're starting to look at much more intently and saying, do we need to mandate the technology that solves for idiocy on the part of the driver?
Yeah. Well, and here's another idea, Joe. Make sure the drivers are better trained.
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
Europeans are traveling on the interstates at 30% higher speeds than we are, and yet their interstate fatality rates are lower. It's because they're a better trained driver. I mean, to get a license in Europe is not
much
easy.
Harder.
Getting a driver's license in Germany is very expensive very proposition, and it's very rigorous.
Well, and not only that, they have much more onerous drunk driving laws, and the social stigma of drunk driving is much
exactly.
harsher, I think.
I think that's where you get at your fatalities now. I mean, the technology and the cars and the roads have gotten you at a very low point, and I think there's needs to be more emphasis now on the driver. I mean, I would advocate having to re-up on your license every once in a while, just like a lot of trade professions.
Look, your driver's ed class should be like a racing school. You should learn to hit the brakes hard enough to feel what the anti-lock brakes feel like.
Yep.
You should corner hard enough to trigger the stability control, accelerate fast enough to trigger the traction control. Because, as we said earlier, when people experience this for the first time, they freeze.
Yeah.
They don't steer out of the way. They don't accelerate out of the way. They don't brake hard enough.
I think that there's something that comes before all of that. You're talking about car control and paying attention. And that is what people are not doing when they're driving their cars.
This is why we need autonomous cars, right?
We're not going to. That's a whole different show, Joe.
Different show. Sorry. Did I say something?
Yeah. Actually, what we got to do is we got a bunch of questions coming in. So I'm going to start throwing out questions to you guys that have been coming in while we've had this discussion. Wright Knight wants to know, will there be a hybrid version of the Colorado and Canyon in the future?
Not anything that they've talked about yet.
Not that I'm aware.
I know in the past Mark Royce has said hybridization in the pickup segment is inevitable. Now, he's talking more like 2020.
Well, he may have said that, but, they've already experimented with that in a big vehicle, and they backed away from it. I mean, it didn't work.
Well, and I think the other advantage that the truck segment has is that diesels have penetrated that segment very well, and the diesels are very efficient. They get the torque mm-hmm. that an electric motor gives you in a hybrid. You look at the Ram, what Chrysler has done with the Ram. I think it's getting 25 mile per gallon
on the highway.
Yeah, which is very good.
Good.
I mean, that's what Ford is trying to meet in this race.
Yeah, when Ford says they're going to be class leading, everybody's got to remember that the Ram has set a pretty decent class leading number that they'll need to overcome.
Well, GM is going to, they're saying, at least with the Canyon and the Colorado, there's going to be a diesel for that in a couple of years.
Yep. With a manual.
Yeah.
That ought to be fun.
Well, I think it's going to be interesting to see, the sort of light-duty diesel, how does that play? And if it plays well, I think you'll see Ford having to match that probably.
Mario Paredes says, did you notice the assembly line Ford had at the Detroit Auto Show? This was part of their exhibit,
Body Shop.
He said, I did some research and found out that Comau, which Fiat owns, will provide all the aluminum welding robots for the 2015 Ford F-150.
Hey, it's revenue. Come on.
This industry is nothing if not incestuous,
That's right. It's a nice touch of irony there. Of course, automakers have been buying Comau production equipment, since the 80s that I know of. George from Sunnyvale heard all our discussion about Ford going. He wonders, did Ford move to aluminum too soon?
Well, to put those last two questions together, one of the interesting things in talking to the GM engineers is that GM has been working with aluminum for a while, and what is different about aluminum? There's so much that goes into aluminum. What's different about aluminum too is that it needs to be. Help me here, guys. It's not bonded. It's riveted.
They have rivets and adhesives, depending on the system.
Yeah, you have to.
Depends on the application.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. So there's a lot more riveting involved here. I mean, GM
says they have a patented welding, aluminum welding process.
They have a new aluminum process, welding process.
Yeah,
that's right.
I don't know. There's a huge amount about, but I know they've talked about it and said that they have it.
And mating aluminum with steel is tricky as well.
Right. So, I think GM's been working with that for a while. I think what's neat about what Ford is doing, and I don't think it's premature because you hear this from all the manufacturers, are going to have to go to more aluminum to meet these regulations which are on the horizon in 2025. And I think what's going to be very beneficial for everybody is the fact that Ford is doing this with 700,000 units a year. So it's going to force the supply line to catch up with these companies. And, it's going to make a lot of things happen. It's going to make it easier for other cars to go aluminum.
Yeah, it's the best news for the aluminum producers such as Alcoa in forever.
Yeah.
One of my colleagues said it's the biggest thing to happen to aluminum since beer cans went from steel to aluminum. And it's a great line, which I wish I had come up with. But I think that's right. If it works, that's the kind of it's a huge
impact. If it works, what do you guys think? Is this thing going to fly or not? Is it going to be a big success?
I think it will fly, but I think it will. I suspect that it will not. If they get the trucks out by the end of the year, it might be just by the end of the year because I think there's some risk that they will be later in delivering, saleable trucks than
production glitches. Or
I think it might take a little longer to get them up to speed. It's a huge program with a fair amount of risk.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that because I know it. I'm just saying that because I think there's obviously some inherent risk in letting
it slip. What Hendrick said, this changes everything.
Yeah, and changing everything is
very risky.
Difficult.
Just one other small piece of this. I mean, the there are not that many body shops that are certified to do aluminum. I mean, right now, what do you got to do, aluminum in an R8 or in an Aston Martin? I mean, now every body shop is going to have to be certified. And Mark Fields told us he's going to waive the certification for Ford trucks just because that's a huge expense to the body shop.
And that goes to the Joe Hendricks line. So now every Ford dealer, at least every Ford dealership, is going to have to invest in that technology, and I don't know who makes that kind of aluminum body shop repairing systems.
Well, panel beaters are going to make a comeback.
Yeah, that's right.
But hey, whoever makes that stuff is in clover, I would think.
We got a couple of phone calls here, Ben. Let's bring in the first.
Hi, this is Jeff W. from Albany, New York. My question for the panel is: does anyone know if the CAFE rules may be at least partly to blame for the increase in size of pickups and the lack of small trucks? I think the rules have some sort of factor with them in regards to the vehicle footprint and the calculated fuel economy or something along those lines. And I just was curious if anybody was knowledgeable about those rules to maybe speak to that. Thanks. Bye.
Henry had touched on this, the footprint.
Yeah. I mean, the caller is basically right that There is some incentive in the rules to make the vehicle cast a larger shadow or have a larger footprint because the target for a given footprint gets easier the bigger the vehicle is. I mean, the rules are not designed to get rid of large vehicles. So the rules are designed. Actually, the rules were kind of designed to take the extremes off at either end.
Right.
Because that was
And to me, it just gets to the fact that you don't want government designing rules like this. I mean, it creates all kinds of perverse, unintended consequences. And let's not forget the reason SUVs are with us today.
It's because
the original KFA essentially eliminated the big car.
The big station wagon.
Right.
Yeah.
And the boys at Chrysler figured out, hey, this Jeep is a pretty capable big car,
and it
doesn't have to meet 27 miles a gallon.
So you get a station wagon with, in many cases, although not all, less cargo room than you might have in a comparable car.
Yeah.
But the caller is basically right. I mean, in fact, if I'm not mistaken, Ford made the new F-150 a little wider, thus with, a larger footprint. And I think they did that probably to a large degree for customer reasons, because the old truck, I think some of their customers thought it was a little too narrow. Hard to believe, but I think they did. but it doesn't hurt for CAFE because it gives them a slightly easier target to hit.
Yeah.
Here's a great question from A.M. Guerrero from Metro Manila in the Philippines. He likes the Ranger that you were talking about that Ford builds worldwide, doesn't sell in the U.S. market. He says, comparing a Ranger to the shortest F-150 is like comparing a Fiesta sedan to a Focus hatchback. He says, don't you think with the right trim and engine mix, it could be sold right alongside the F-150 in North America?
GM thinks something similar. I mean,
yeah, but GM just got out of that market in 2010. So why is it getting back in? And I think that speaks more to regulation than it does to the consumer market. I mean, you know, if you've got the money to buy a truck and the gas is $3 a gallon, why are you going to buy a mid-sized truck instead of an F-150?
Yeah. And that gets back to the point about cannibalization. It just seems to me that Ford has taken a view that they are best served selling as many F-series trucks as they possibly can. And that cannibalizing with, you know, 100,000 or 80,000 Rangers that, you know, that drop out F-series, you know, some share of F-series sales is not worth it.
Right. But can Ford now discount, I mean, given the cost they put in the F-150, can they discount the F-150s now down to mid-sized segment prices? Again, that's where this war between GM and Ford is going to get interesting.
It's going to be the Battle of Britain, as Joe said. Let's see. We got a bunch of stuff here. Abhi Kumar says, I want to ask your view of the new Volvo XC Coupe. He says, I mean, I really just love it. Volvo makes some nice designs that go ages back. I liked that XC Coupe.
I liked it, too. I think when it comes out in real life, it's going to have four doors. I liked it. I talked to them about it. I think it is a nice look for them. And, you know, God knows they need a new look. They're way, way late with a fresh approach.
Yeah, which is great. Great for Sweden. I mean, having lost Saab, it's nice to see Volvo still pumping out neat designs.
Volvo is an interesting company, too, because if their parent, Geely, the Chinese company, can really start to figure out how to build into their products the Volvo's designs for safety and the credible sort of global architecture, Geely could really be one of the breakout companies from China. So, I mean, that seems to be their play. I don't know if it's going to work, but that's the play. It's an interesting evolution.
Don't you feel that Volvo is, their position right now is kind of tenuous?
Right now, yeah. Yeah. I mean, they're
dying. Well, they're dying. They've had no new product forever.
Again, anybody who goes to the Detroit Auto Show or any auto show is just going to see this unbelievable avalanche of product from the three big German luxury brands. We haven't talked about it, but it's stunning what they're doing and the amount of money that they're putting into the product. It's astounding.
Here's an interesting one. Robert McElroy, no relation, wants to know, is there a possibility Chrysler could put that 3-liter diesel in the Grand Caravan or Town and Country?
Well, it goes back to the earlier question about the hybridization of trucks. I don't think you need to hybridize trucks because that segment is accepted diesel. The problem with the mass consumer markets is that diesel has never been popular here. And so I think that's one thing that pushed the manufacturers to hybrid. They needed a new alternative powertrain to sell because diesel has never done well. It's never done well in Japan either. Why the Prius is
China
the best,
either.
Yeah, best-selling car in Japan. I just think that's a tricky thing.
I don't doubt
VW is interesting, but I think it's a tricky thing to do in the consumer market.
I don't doubt that Chrysler's looked at it because in talking to Bob Lee, who's now their head of powertrain sort of broadly, you know, my sense is that, you know, Chrysler, which does have a bit of a cafe problem and they need to get better, that Chrysler's, you know, does a pretty, you know, thorough sort of cost-benefit analysis of applying different technologies across all their products. And I don't doubt they've looked at diesel in the minivan, but I think maybe Henry's right that in that segment, it's not necessarily going to fly.
Well, I think everyone's going to watch. How does the diesel Cruze sell? How does the Ram diesel, the light-duty one sell?
Diesel Cruze really hasn't even made a dent yet.
No, it hasn't. And, you know, up until early December, it was only available like in 12 markets around the country.
Yeah.
So it's only just now getting available.
Yeah. It's $28,000. I mean, again, that's
pricey.
Yeah, I mean, hybrids have the same problem. It's $28,000. It's a Cruze base is $20,000, and they're selling a diesel for $28,000.
Yeah, that's
a tough price point.
That might be a tough price point.
Okay, we got another phone call here. Ben, let's bring that one in.
Hi, guys. It's Jonathan out in Overhead. Fabulous panel. Great show. Missing Peter. My question is, with regards to Mark Royce's statements at the Z06 release, he said it was a no-compromise performance option, the automatic 8-speed shifting faster than a PDK, blah, blah, blah. You guys believe it? Is it going to track as fast as the 7-speed rev-matching manual? I've been driving manuals for 35 years, but I'm entertaining the automatic, and I was just curious what your panel's opinion will be. Will the automatic 8-speed Z06 be as fast on the track, the road course, as the rev-matching 7-speed?
I think
it's going to be. Thank you very much. Great show.
I think it's going to be at least as fast, and that technology. And I'm like you. I love shifting your involvement with the vehicle, you know, doing it manually. But I've been seduced by some of the very good automated manuals and PDK, and I think this one's going to be very good.
Yeah, for them to be able to claim that this torque converter step gear transmission will shift faster than a dual clutch transmission is saying something.
But I mean, and
very bold.
And this is Tony's area, not mine so much. But I do think that you should not underestimate what's the amount of technology that's going on. I mean, when people talk about technology in the car, they tend to think of, you know, the nonsense that's going on in the dashboard. I think that's almost the least interesting technology that's going on in cars. It's this stuff that's truly amazing. What they're now able to do with software and electronic controls.
But to the question about automatics. I mean, what's fascinating to me about the Z06, it was developed in parallel with the C7R. I mean, we're used to going to the auto show and seeing race cars around the periphery. These two were introduced together. I mean, you have racing a racing program that was developed in conjunction with a production car, a very good production car, but still they were side by side. And if you go on the racetrack, the paddle shifts in modern race cars. It's been this way for 5 or 6 years. You don't have to lift your foot. I mean, you keep your foot planted and you go through the paddles. And I still think to any driver, that's going to be more satisfying than an automatic transmission that decides for you. Every driver has their own style. Every driver has to adapt to the conditions, and I think the paddle shifts are so good that that's going to be the optimum way to drive the Z06.
You know, and this is not a new question, but I got to say that, I mean, this new Corvette, I wonder when and how GM is going to do a better job of leveraging the value and the amazing technology and the wonderful design that they've lavished on that new Vette and all the new Vettes. And use it to help them sell the vehicles that they really need to sell, and spread some of that design boldness and technology boldness to the rest of the field. And now that Mark Royce is head of product development, and I'm sure this happened before he was, but they've got to figure out how to do that.
But that's a marketing thing, I think. You know, you've got to be able to come in.
It's got to be both substance and marketing.
You got to come into the showroom to ogle this beautiful Stingray, and then you've got to have similar or cars with same color paint, similar kind of wheels that are Malibus, Cruises, right. And whatever.
And honestly, and you know who's doing? I think, frankly, one of the reasons why the German luxury brands have been so successful is I think the Germans are doing a better job of that. I mean, and I'll just use Mercedes as an example. One of the things I saw at the show. So they have the S-Class, which is, you know, all singing and all dancing. It's got, you know, can practically drive itself now. A little, you know, 2 years it will drive itself, but it practically can drive itself now. It's just bristling with technology. Then they also have the new E-Class. And the new C-Class, which will have a lot of the very same technology.
Yeah.
So the Mercedes is using the S-Class very aggressively as a halo and saying, you know what, you remember last year we had this incredible stuff? Well, now we've put it in our less expensive cars.
Yeah.
But what's interesting about the Corvette is the Corvette has actually benefited from the mass production of GM. I mean, the reason you can produce this $50,000 wonder that has the same performance as a $100,000 Porsche or a $200,000 Ferrari is because it benefits from the mass production.
From the scale, yeah.
The absolutely. Scale that GM has and the pushrod truck engines they've developed for years. So they can keep those costs down versus the hand-build sports car makers. So it seems high time now that this athletic car, now maybe the design can start to trickle downstream, just as you're saying the Mercedes has done, because you look at the Cruises and the Malibus, and they're very vanilla compared to some of the other products you see coming out of Ford, out of Hyundai.
Yeah,
Hyundai.
And it's particularly striking now since they brought out the new generation Vette. I mean, that contrast has always been there, but it's particularly striking now, and it'd just be interesting to see how GM tries to do that because they need to.
Yeah, a little bit tangential though, you know, talking about the race car, you know, coming with the C7 chassis without much change at all, and that tells you something about the chassis that you're going to be able to buy. It, because race cars, typically you get a body in white to start with that, and it doesn't resemble a street car at all, but this is a little different.
Sure, no, I mean, Tad Zucker, you know, chief engineer,
right,
will tell you how, you know, Pratt and Miller had a lot of direct input into saying, geez, do this with the tumble home, take the backlight to this angle, blah, 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 blah. So, I mean, this is where they've taken track knowledge and baked it into the car from the beginning.
Which is rare. You know, the stuff about technology transfer from racing is frequently, you know, just smoke. But in this case, it's true.
Yeah. Well, and you have an aluminum chassis. I mean, for all this talk about the aluminum skin in the F-150, here is GM making a 90,000 unit a year. How many are they
selling?
Corvettes?
Oh, God. I think they'll be 50? Lucky to do 30.
Yeah, well, they're selling 35.
30 globally. Yeah. It's 25 in the U.S.
Yeah, it's a low-volume vehicle for sure.
But still on an assembly line, producing an aluminum chassis. So will that benefit GM? Will they be ahead of the game on aluminum chassis?
Well, you know, we talked about this aluminum welding technique.
Body, though.
I'll bet you that VET is really putting that technology to work, and that's one of the ways that you can prove out mass volume is, you know, okay, 25, 30,000, whatever Corvettes they make. That's actually kind of high volume, not compared to a Silverado. Compared to Ferrari, though, it's what, you know, four times their annual production. So, so you can learn a lot of things, and that's one of the things that makes the VET, you know, a program that GM wants to stick with.
Yeah, I think in different ways and in different scales, the Corvette and the F-150 are about the same thing, and that is, how do you manage technology risk? You know, how do you take technology risk, and how do you innovate? And the pressure to do those things, to innovate and to manage technology risk and take risks that you might not have taken 5 years ago or 10 years ago, that's going to be critical going forward. I mean, that's what both of those cars say.
How do you market it?
And how do you market it?
Yeah. And you look across this show, and the buzz was the big three. I mean, the big three is back. And the other thing that fascinated me about this show is that you look at icons like the F-150 and the Mustang and the Corvette, and these companies, particularly in the case of the Corvette and the Mustang, are looking at those now as global products. I mean, they're really much more aggressive now at pushing those products out in a global sphere, and it'll be interesting to see how they do.
Well, hey, look, we ought to wrap this up. It's been a great discussion. So, Tony Swan, great having you here.
Thank you.
Joe White and Henry Payne.
Thank you. Host McElroy.
And Host McElroy, and I especially want to thank everybody who's been listening in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.